It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a law and women's studies expert about the legislation unveiled today aimed at combating campus sexual assault.
First, we're learning about a new theory being used to explain regional differences. There can be big cultural differences in different parts of the United States. The South can be perceived as more politically conservative. The Northeast may be more liberal. The Pacific Northwest, more laid back. The list goes on.
One psychologist decided to try and figure out why there are such different outlooks on life, why they're so region-centered. She's here to discuss the theory that might explain these differences, centering on the idea of how tight or loose a region is when it comes to social norms and those who deviate from them. Michelle Gelfand is a professor of psychology and distinguished university scholar teacher at the University of Maryland. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, to start, we probably all have a sense that, yeah, we're different from region to region. Why did you decide to dig deeper into the causes or behind those differences?
Well, you know, states vary a lot on historical and ecological conditions, on the types of people that populate them, and also their outcomes. But there's been very little to date any kind of theory research to help explain this variation. So why, for example, is the incidence of illicit substance abuse greater in states like Hawaii and New Hampshire relative to Mississippi and Ohio, but incidents of discrimination are much higher in the latter than the former? Or why do some states like Oregon and Vermont have high levels of creativity but low levels of social organization, meaning that they have high mobility and divorce, whereas other states like Kentucky and North Dakota exhibit the exact opposite patterns? We were interested, is there a parsimonious explanation? And we thought there might be.
And the explanation you focus on has been called the tightness-looseness theory. What is that?
That's right. This is a distinction that originated in anthropology in the late 60s, where Pietro Pelto was studying traditional societies and found that across over 20 traditional societies, that he could differentiate them in terms of how tight or loose they are. Tight cultures meaning that they have strong norms and low tolerance for deviant behavior, and loose cultures meaning they have very weak norms and have a high tolerance of deviant behavior. And after that study, we actually published a paper in Science that used this distinction to understand modern societies. We surveyed over 7,000 people across 33 nations and over 20 languages, and were able to show that nations around the world also vary in how tight and loose they are. And we thought, well, maybe this distinction can help us understand our own state variation.
So when you're surveying people in a state, what are you looking at to find out if it's more on the tight or loose end of the spectrum?
That's a great question. So in this particular study, we wanted to get data that were really reflective of the strength of punishment in states and the degree of latitude, because this is the core aspect of the construct of tightness and looseness. So we gathered data on things like the percentage of students that are hit in schools as an indication of severity of punishment, or the execution rate, or the severity of punishment for violating laws, as well as latitude and permissiveness, access to alcohol, for example, ratio of dry to total counties that allow alcohol. And we submitted these this data to what's called a factor analysis, and found that there was a very strong, clear factor that differentiated the states, where we can rank order states on the degree to which they had strong norms and little tolerance for deviance and low latitude versus weak norms and a lot of latitude.
And so what did we find? Who was at each end of this tight, loose spectrum?
That's a great question. So the tightest states were located in the South, included Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Texas. The loosest states were in the East Coast as well as in the West, including Maine and Nevada, Washington State, Oregon, and California. And what we were interested in testing is something that we found predicted tightness in the international level, and that is to say that societies and also states, as we found, that are tight tend to have a lot of ecological and man-made threats. So in other words, what correlated with this index were things like natural disasters. States that were very tight have a much higher level of tornado risk and other types of death rates due to heat and lightning and storms. They have lower natural resources. They have higher disease and health vulnerabilities. And our theory is that when any group, state or nation, experiences a lot of threat, they need greater, stronger norms in order to survive. They need them to coordinate. And that seems to be a principle that we found explains tightness both in the international data and also within the context of the 50 states.
So is this historically these states have had those conditions, or even on into the present day, those conditions behind the tightness and looseness, we can observe them today?
Exactly. We gathered data from a wide range of sources, and were able to show very strong connection between ecological and historical types of variables and tightness. In the international data, you could see that even things like population density in the year 1500 predict tightness. When you have contexts that have a lot of density, a lot of people per square mile, you require greater rules and to coordinate that behavior, or there could be great chaos. So that's right. You can see this both historically and also contemporaneously. The other thing that we were able to show was that states that are tight and loose vary very much in the types of people that populate them. So, for example, tight states have people that are higher on what we call conscientiousness, people who are more rule-abiding, but they tend to be lower on what's called trait openness, openness to experience. And loose states have the exact opposite pattern. They have people that have lower conscientiousness, and they also have people that have higher on openness. And there's other connections between things like creativity and discrimination. So, for example, loose states have actually a lot higher creativity and lower discrimination, whereas tight states have lower creativity and higher discrimination. At the same time, tight states tend to have more stability. They have more self-control, so they have less divorce, they have less mobility, and they have higher self-control in the sense of having less substance abuse and less homelessness as compared to loose states, which have much lower rates of self-control, much lower rates of stability, and higher homelessness. So in a way, you could think about this as depending from your vantage point, both tightness and looseness have different sources of advantages and disadvantages.
Right. When I've seen your article in the or your research in the media, a lot of the comments are along the lines of, aha, my tightness or looseness is better. It's a value judgment on it. You're not making that value judgment. It kind of how we weigh these depends on the values we bring in the first place.
I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, as I said, it really depends on your vantage point in terms of what kind of criteria is the most important to you. Self-control and order and predictability are things that go along with tightness, but they also have other effects of having lower creativity and higher discrimination, less openness to others. Likewise, looseness has much less self-control, much less stability, but more creativity and less discrimination. I would say that I think the extremes of both, we don't find this necessarily in the United States, but we do find it internationally, but the extremes of both, extremely tight and extremely loose, we find both have disadvantages, probably for different reasons. So if you're living in a context that's extremely loose, it's very hard to coordinate behavior and there's a sense of anomy and a sense of meaninglessness. But if you're living in a very extreme tight state or nation, that can also be very repressive. But as I said, in the U.S., we don't seem to have that extreme variation because we're part of the same country, of course. But we do see that internationally, the extremes do have disadvantages across the board for things like health and other subjective well-being outcomes.
Josh on our Facebook page wonders what the authors think. He writes about the different groups of European settlers and the impact they have on tightness and looseness. So do you think there's some impact on the conditions from the old country when people settled here?
I think certainly that's the case. I think you can see that, you know, in the context where you have people migrating toward the frontiers, toward California, for example, that had that kind of openness and wound up settling there, you see that that's helped to promote that kind of mentality. So there's, you know, certainly an effect of settlers. There's also an effect, like I said, of ecology, of what's happening in terms of the environment that these states are facing, whether it's natural disasters or food supply. So there's both top-down from the environment and also bottom-up types of effects from the settlers, as the author would surmise.
So can we drill in even closer, say, within a state? I know here in Wisconsin, people between Madison and Milwaukee may look at each other as a different world or rural parts of the state and the cities. Can we use this tool on a closer-up level?
I absolutely think so, because, in fact, the index that we developed, the data that we assessed it on, actually, there's certainly community-level data that's available on some of the indices that we collect at the state level. And I think that in any state, you know, you could find variability within the state as well. California, for example, though it's very loose, likely has, you know, clearly some pockets of tightness. Likewise, Louisiana, which is quite tight, has pockets of looseness. And I would imagine also Wisconsin has the same phenomenon. And I think that we could measure it and look to see where that variation is.
So your research is a great conversation starter. How are you hoping people use this theory down the road?
Well, you know, what we're trying to do is help people understand a wide range of differences through a more parsimonious conceptual roof. You know, maybe the terms tightness and looseness people sometimes misunderstand because they're colloquial. We kind of drew on them from established scientific literature and wanted the continuity to use them. But we think it's important that people understand that there's a reason why differences exist within nations, across nations, that can be parsimoniously explained by tightness and looseness. We think that it's a major component of any social system where you have to deal with degrees of constraint or latitude. So, for example, you can also sort of drill down into the organizational and industry level. We can think about how industries vary in terms of tightness and looseness as adaptations to their own environments. We can think about the military versus civilians and how these cultures might also be differentiated across the lines of tightness and looseness. And so I think it provides an organizing principle that can help us to understand and explain variation in a lot of different contexts.
And maybe help us talk to each other.
That's right.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. Very interesting research.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That's Michelle Gelfand. She's professor of psychology and distinguished university scholar teacher at the University of Maryland. A look at new legislation to combat sexual assault on college campuses introduced today by a bipartisan group of senators. The law would require schools to take anonymous survey results on campus assaults and share them with the public. It would also put a financial burden on schools that don't comply with some of the new requirements.
Aaron Bezuvis is with us to talk about the legislation called the Campus Accountability and Safety Act. She's a professor at Western New England University School of Law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Studies. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So what would the Campus Accountability and Safety Act do? What would it change if it were passed?
Yeah, well, the proposed new legislation has a number of provisions that seem to be aimed at strengthening prevention and campus response to sexual assault that occurs. And then it has another set of provisions that seem to be aimed at, as you already mentioned, holding schools accountable in terms of exacting a penalty from schools who don't comply. So in that first category, the provisions that are aimed at prevention and response, a provision requires a nationwide survey to help get a handle on the scope of the problem of sexual violence. Another example is a requirement that campus provide specially trained personnel to deal with the issue of campus assault. A requirement that they provide special advisors to victims to help coordinate the kind of support they need, including whether that might be educational accommodations or like serve as a liaison with campus authorities or local law enforcement. There's a prohibition in the bill that would ban colleges from punishing students who report sexual violence in good faith, and that's a provision that seems to me aimed at the problem of underreporting, because oftentimes victims fear, especially if there has been mutual underage drinking, that reporting sexual assault under that environment could blow back on them. Other requirements, colleges and universities couldn't, under this new law, have separate campus disciplinary procedures for certain subunits or subgroups on campus. For example, an athletic department that might want to handle internally an issue of sexual violence that occurs in a way that differs from the rest of campus, that would be prohibited.
Now, this bill had a bipartisan support, quite a lot of it, which can be a rarity these days. Can you put into context for us why that is and why this has emerged as such a pressing issue?
Yeah, I'm not surprised that it has bipartisan support for as you say, it has really become an issue in the last couple of years that has taken on a large scale public focus, and I think that's definitely due to a lot of the recent reporting about the widespread nature of the problem. The government has released recent reports, the White House Task Force report, for example, as well as other policy statements by the Office for Civil Rights that have talked about such statistics as the number one in five women are believed to be victims of sexual assault while in college, and even 3% of men have reported experiencing sexual violence while in college. So I think that the nature of the problem, as illustrated by statistics like that, has really put this issue on the map. But in addition to that, it's also come to light recently the degree to which schools in the past have tried to suppress the exposure of instances of sexual assault that have occurred on their campus, and that's something that has been the subject of lots of recent government investigations that have received a lot of press. And so I think that's also motivating the bipartisan support.
Now, you mentioned the number one in five women on a college campus have been sexually assaulted, according to a new study. But there's still the concern out there that even this number could be an underreported number. Why do we think that now?
Yeah, well, I mean, just to put that one in five number in an even scarier context, in 2000, the Department of Justice estimated that less than 5% of victims who are attending college actually report sexual violence to college officials. Wow, so that could be the tip of the iceberg, that one in five number, and that's definitely a scary thought. Now, hopefully since 2000, especially in light of the recent attention paid to universities making a renewed commitment to addressing sexual assault, it has helped curb the problem of underreporting by making students feel like their concerns will be taken seriously if they do report. But in the past, that's definitely been a problem. There has been very little incentive to report if you felt like there was, not going to be a fair process, that, colleges and universities weren't motivated to actually expel or otherwise discipline a student who's found responsible for sexual violence, probably out of concern for either litigation by a student who was found responsible, or concern for the negative publicity, or concern for the lost tuition that would result from expelling a student for sexual assault. So all of those things sort of stacked up on the side of schools not wanting to, not really having an incentive to take sexual assault seriously. And up until this recent wave of Title IX enforcement, there's been very little legal action on the other side that provides a sort of counterbalance that would make schools equally interested in taking their responsibility to address sexual assault seriously.
Now, to look at one aspect of this proposed legislation, penalties that could be levied against universities that aren't compliant with the new law, they could lose up to 1% of their operating budget. Now, as I understand, there are already penalties on the books. Why isn't that working?
Right. I think that that's actually the most important thing in this new proposed legislation, because the Department of Education, in terms of enforcing Title IX, has really been somewhat hamstrung by the only available penalty that it has at its disposal, and that's the penalty to withdraw all federal funding. And that has really turned out to be a penalty that's too big to use. Because what that would result in is, not only, grants for research and things like that that might be federally supported, but also all federal financial aid to students would be terminated at that point. And the Department of Education realizes that if they ever took that step, they would be punishing the very students whose civil rights they are, supposed to protect. So it hasn't ever really been able to leverage that particular penalty, which means that it's kind of enforcement has been relatively toothless, at least in terms of motivating proactive compliance. All a university, a cynical university might say, well, why would we proactively comply with Title IX? Because the worst thing that would happen is that someone could file a complaint, Department of Education would show up, they would investigate us, they would find that we had a violation, and then at that point they would make us promise to fix it and comply going forward. Well, okay, that doesn't really motivate proactive compliance when the worst case scenario is a promise to comply going forward. So now, under this new proposed legislation, should it pass, the threat would be an actual financial penalty that I think is it's small enough that we could see it feasibly being used by the Department of Education, but large enough that it would actually motivate compliance.
We're talking right now with Aaron Bezuvis about a new bipartisan measure unveiled today aimed at trying to curb campus sexual assault. We're continuing our conversation with Aaron Bezuvis about the newly introduced Campus Accountability and Safety Act.
The bill was unveiled earlier today by a bipartisan group of U.S. senators. It aims to hold universities and colleges more accountable for sexual assaults that occur on their campuses. We want to hear from you about this issue at 800-642-1234. Do you think that institutions of higher education need to be a bigger part of the solution to sexual assault on campus? From what you've heard of this law, do you think this is the right direction to go? Do you think Congress needs to hold universities' feet to the fire on this issue? What would you like to see them do? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org.
We're going to go right to the phones and take Matt in Middleton. Hi, Matt.
Hello. I just had a question about kind of the role of the police departments, and if the guests could clarify kind of where the boundary lines are between university and the police, because it seems like sexual assault to me is a very serious crime and it should be handled through the police department. So it seems to me if they're having problems with this, it's because the police aren't investigating. And is there a difference between campus police and regular police? So it seems kind of odd to me that they would have a university, an academic institution, be investigating sexual crime. Seems like an odd role place upon a university. So if you could clarify for that, and I'll take my answer out the air.
All right. Thank you, Matt. And Matt, getting at what a lot of critics have voiced, that there's too much jurisdiction going on by the universities here themselves, handling it themselves, and not enough accountability. But why do you think it is arranged the way it is right now, Aaron?
Right. Well, it's not... I want to put out there that it's not an either-or proposition. It's not as if campus sexual assault can only either be a criminal matter or a matter of university discipline. It's actually always already both. The problem is that it winds up that university discipline is really the only mechanism for effectively dealing with campus assault, because the burden of proof on prosecutors is awfully high, appropriately so in criminal matters when you're talking about somebody's liberty being at stake in the form of criminal penalties. It's really difficult to prove all manners of sexual violence, but especially campus sexual violence, to the kind of beyond a reasonable doubt level that would be required to actually win a case in court. So prosecutors, and not just campus assault, but rape in general, is not an issue that gets very much criminal prosecution. So by default, even though I said both of those things are active, by default that kind of leaves campus assault as the what appears to be to the public as the only way that campus assault is being handled. I guess to address Matt's other question about isn't this, do we really want universities handling severe crimes? Well, I mean, let me take it out of the context of a sexual assault for a second, just to maybe try to make a point in a different way. If one of my students knifed another of my students, I would hope that we would expel that student, right? I mean, there would be very little controversy, I think, if a university disciplinary proceeding occurred and if that student was found responsible for a physical assault, that for the sake of safety of every other student, that student who committed that act of violence would be expelled. And it's not very common that one student knifes another student, but when it does happen, when other forms of assault do happen on campus, of course universities deal with it in a disciplinary procedure, because they are trying to protect their other students. So what this bill and other aspects of Title IX enforcement aimed at sexual assault are actually trying to do is to make sure that sexual assault is also being taken seriously by university disciplinary proceedings. It's not singling out sexual assault as the only thing, the only conduct that could also be considered criminal that universities are taking seriously. But the idea is, if you've got to keep your students safe, and you've got to respect their civil rights. And so part of that is taking the same care that you would in investigating and disciplining a student who rapes another student as you would a student who commits any other kind of crime or harm against another student.
Well, thank you so much for that call. We're going to go next to Kate in Green Bay. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to say that I completely agree with everything that was just said. I think that campuses should have greater involvement with the punishment and follow through for any sexual assault cases on campus. I know that as a woman, and I went to a public college, it's definitely something that you experience, that's thought about, and it's in our culture now. I mean, there are articles and magazines, even such things like Cosmo warning women about campus sexual assault. And I mean, I will be a mother someday. That's something that I will definitely consider if I have a daughter, that I want to know that the campus that she's going to fully complies with the safety regulations, with the follow through of the punishment, that's an upstanding institution, that the campus is known for that. And I think that they should be held accountable to these punishments and the fines that they say they're going to pay that's being enforced right now. I think that that's something, unfortunately, that our culture has come to that point that we need to be bringing these things up, and we need to come down harder on these issues, and campuses should be fully involved with them.
All right. Thank you so much, Kate. And what do you say to that, Aaron?
Well, Kate's comment actually reminds me of another part of this proposed law that addresses the issue of transparency, that I think could make it much easier for students and their parents in the future to be able to make decisions about which campus environment is going to be right for them. Part of the proposed new legislation would require the Department of Education to make public the names of all institutions that are being investigated for violations of Title IX, as well as the kinds of responses that universities that are found non-compliant are going to have to take in order to come into compliance. So, I think that gives a little bit more information to the average consumer, if you will, about how different schools are addressing the scope of the problem at different schools and how it's being handled.
And also, in terms of transparency, aren't schools also now, according to this bill, supposed to conduct a survey about who reports it and then post it online so parents and students can check it out?
Yeah, that's another part of it. And a related law, the Clery Act, also speaks to that very issue of transparency. That's a statute that's been on the books for a while that has required schools to report crime statistics of all kinds. And last year, the Clery Act was amended to require not only reporting of crime statistics, including, of course, offenses of sexual violence, but also to make public the ways in which schools are acting to prevent and respond to sexual violence. So that, too, is going to add to the kind of information that consumers are going to have available to them in order to, through the marketplace, if you will, hold schools responsible for their, for problems or lack of problems regarding sexual assault.
As we mentioned, there are other laws on the books that have been geared toward preventing and sexual assault and holding colleges accountable. What is there in this bill to provide a little more teeth, a little more enforcement to make sure that this new law goes enforced and observed?
Right. Well, a lot of the provisions of this law are actually really familiar to people who've been following along the requirements that the Department of Education has made in the context of its 2011 Dear Colleague letter, which puts a lot of specific requirements on schools in terms of how they respond and prevent sexual assault. A recent White House task force report that was published last May was another source of recommendations that are kind of echoed in this proposed new legislation. But what this new statute would do, if it were passed, would be to take some of these requirements that exist in, for example, the recommendations of the task force, turn something that's a recommendation into something that's a requirement. And then as it would affect the kinds of requirements that are in the Dear Colleague letter, it would amplify them so that they would not just be requirements of a federal agency, but actually requirements of Congress, which would make them more potentially more permanent. Because, frankly, as useful as the Dear Colleague letter is in terms of specifying more clearly the legal requirements under Title IX on colleges and universities for dealing with this issue, under the next presidential administration, a new Secretary of Education could revoke that letter tomorrow. I mean, not tomorrow, but, revoke that letter, summarily without having to go through any kind of process. But if statutory requirements are passed, it takes a great deal more effort to amend or repeal legislation. So I think that's why, even though a lot of these requirements are already existing, either in terms of the Dear Colleague Letters requirements or recommendations from the task force, this would make them mandatory and would make them more permanent.
Now, we talked about some of the statistics earlier on. 1 in 5 women reported being sexually assaulted in college, for instance, is one that's out there right now. Should this law pass, do you see this making a difference in how safe women feel in college?
Well, I think it would. I think it would make a difference. I think it's I think it's a difference that's measured against what is already happening, which is schools are already starting to take more responsibility for this issue, and that's a good thing, and that's a result of the increased enforcement under Title IX, the Dear Colleague Letter, the White House Task Force Report, and things like that. So I think part of what this new legislation would do is to make sure that there's no backsliding on that. Like I said before, to make sure that if there's a change in administration and the Dear Colleague Letter goes away, that there would still be a source of legal requirement so that schools wouldn't be able to go back to the old days. So that and the enforcement provision that I mentioned earlier, the fact that schools would have even more motivation to avoid that penalty that could amount to 1% of their operating budgets, that too will keep them honest. And I think that that will help to ensure that the positive changes that I think we're already seeing are lasting.
Erin, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Erin Bezuvis, professor at Western New England University School of Law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Studies.
Time now for Wisconsin Life. Frank Lloyd Wright's architectural masterpiece Taliesin draws people from around the world to Spring Green. Longtime Taliesin resident Minerva Montooth shares her memories and what it's like to reside in a living monument.
The house burned twice. 3 times, maybe, I don't know. History. I want to live in the present, but the house burned, but it never burned this part. And Mr. Wright said, God is judging my life, but not my work, because his work was in here. He had a vault in here, and this part never burned. This is just a beautiful space. You feel that opening feeling of space. It's just so different from any other architect. And this was built in 1911. Mr. Wright and Mrs. Wright both dreamed, before they even met, of having a school. Mrs. Wright wanted it to be philosophical, and Mr. Wright wanted it to be architectural. In 1932, they decided this is the time to start a school and have young people come into their lives. Each one of these apprentices paid $600 a year, and some people thought that was outrageous that they had to pay to come here and work. But that's what they did. They learned from Mr. Wright by working with him. Mr. Wright called the curriculum, he said, you know what that really means? That word means the runaround. So he didn't believe in curriculum, and he didn't believe in working toward a degree. He believed in working toward becoming an architect, and then you were. We just did everything in the early years. He wanted to be self-sufficient. He had diesel power from the water that went over the dam. He had a farm for vegetables. He had cows and chickens for eggs. People have to come here wanting to be here because it's such a different life, and it's hard 12 months a year. You don't have any time off. You're dedicated to architecture. Mr. Wright and Mrs. Wright never wanted this to be a museum, and I don't want it to be a museum, and I don't want people to have the idea it's a museum, because that's dead. That's what was, and this is still going. It is home. It has been for 59 years. Charles and I had our 59th wedding anniversary 2 weeks ago. Mr. and Mrs. Wright are right here. As far as I'm concerned, you know, I just expect Mrs. Wright to be coming in that door or Mr. Wright to come this way. Just their spirit is so much here that I feel they're a part of our lives.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. You can catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Monday nights at 8. For more info, head to wisconsinlife.org or search for Wisconsin Life on Facebook. Arborists from around the world are gathering in Wisconsin this weekend to put their professional skills to the test and maybe have some fun along the way.
The International Tree Climbing Championships start this Saturday in Milwaukee. And here to tell us more about the competition is Shelley Wollerman. She's a certified arborist and one of the two tree climbers from Wisconsin who will be competing in the International Tree Climbing Championships. Shelley, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
So let's get acquainted with this event. What happens at it?
The competition consists of one day of preliminary events and then a master's challenge on the second day. The preliminaries consist of five different events. There is a work climb where you start at the top of the tree and have to hit four or five bells in the tree and work your way down. There is an aerial rescue where they set up a dummy in the tree and give them an injury, and you have to work your way into the tree and get them down safely. There is a throw line event where you have to install a couple of climbing lines into a tree, and the higher you get the climbing line into the tree, the more points you get. And then there is a belayed speed climb where you climb from the bottom of the tree to the top of the tree as fast as you can, basically using just the limbs of the tree itself. And then footlock is an event where you have to pull yourself up a rope about 50 feet, basically, as fast as you can.
And Shelley, when I first heard about this, I thought tree climbing and the image of kids frolicking, climbing up a couple branches popped into my head. This is not that. This is some serious work you're doing here.
Yes, yes. It is. International is very serious. I mean, people from around the world, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, they take it very seriously, and they train pretty much year-round so that they have a shot at winning the competition.
Now, something tells me that there are not a whole lot of champion tree climbers in the world. How do you become one?
It kind of starts out, like you said, I am a certified arborist, and so the ISA has local chapter, so I'm a member of the Wisconsin chapter, and so each chapter has its own competition locally, and then the winner of that competition gets to attend the international competition.
How long have you been working up in the trees, Shelley?
It has been about 4 years, probably.
And have you been competing that whole time?
Yes, I have. It didn't take me long to start competing once I started climbing trees, so.
Now, you wouldn't be doing this if it weren't a labor of love. What do you love about being up there in a tree, and in particular in climbing a tree?
It's something different every day. I mean, you're going to a different job site every day. You're not doing the same thing. I mean, each tree and each job is completely different from the next, so it's kind of a nice variety, and it doesn't get old at all.
And you mentioned there's the rescue event where you go up the tree and rescue an injured dummy as it happens. I understand you, when you got into doing this work, also got some EMT training. Why did you do that?
I became a licensed EMT at the basic level because I know tree climbing is a very dangerous job because you are working with chainsaws and you're using them in trees. I mean, especially in storm damage, you're using chainsaws on the ground, and things can react very differently. So I figured the more that I knew about safety and how to deal with things, the better off our company and our crew would be. So if anything did happen, I would be able to deal with it until paramedics come.
Now, Shelley, most of us are never going to make it up to the top of a tree like you do, sounds like, just about every day. What is the view like up there?
I don't know. There's a couple of places. It doesn't happen very often, but there's usually a couple of trees that are tall enough, and if you're kind of working on the lake or on a hillside, you can just, once you get up there, you have a really nice view of just the landscape and all of the trees, or a view across the lake of the Capitol. I mean, it's pretty amazing. It doesn't happen very often, but if you're in the right location, you have some pretty nice views.
I suppose a lot of time the view from up in a tree is all the other trees.
Yes, pretty much.
So I'm not a big climbing guy. I imagine this takes a lot of upper body strength, both to do the work you do and to compete. How do you train, or is doing the work training enough to stay in shape?
For me, doing the work is training enough. I really don't train a whole lot. I might get together with a couple of friends to practice foot locking every once in a while. But I mean, I'm usually in trees every day, so I consider that my training.
And this weekend, you've got the home field advantage, being one of the two climbers from Wisconsin to compete. Does that add any extra pressure?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. I was actually really looking forward to this competition because it is, you know, my home competition, because I know there's going to be a lot of people there that I know, and I was very excited to have that kind of background, I guess.
And can people come out and watch? And if so, what should we be looking for up in the trees?
Yep, people are definitely invited to watch. I would probably bring a lawn chair. There's going to be 5 different trees that are set up, usually in a smaller area, so that you can kind of tell, and each event is marked off by cones and it's all taped off. But I mean, you're free to walk around throughout the entire day to different events. I mean, it's kind of, there's a rotation of different 5 or 6 different groups so that you hit all of the stations. But I mean, it's, if you sit down and watch the work climb for an hour or two, I mean, even an hour, you're going to see some amazing climbers work that tree, and you will be, I guarantee you will be impressed by going out and coming to the competition. It's just, it's amazing to watch if you've never seen it before.
Well, Shelley, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Shelley Wollerman, a certified arborist and one of the two tree climbers from Wisconsin who will be competing in the International Tree Climbing Championships this weekend in Milwaukee.